losses add up.
STP.
Yes, Chris?
I just want to make one comment. It keeps being said, a few people have said it, there's loss in the tuner itself. There is absolutely zero loss in the tuner. And when I say zero, I mean anything we're going to be able to measure, unless you have a $10,000 piece of equipment to measure it. It's almost immeasurable. There's zero heat or loss in the tuner itself. It's really feeble as that signal bounces back and forth. And I can run my tuner for 10 days in a row and keep it keyed up for 10 days in a row. It's ice cold. There's zero heat in there.
Yes, and I'm sorry. I'll get to you in 1 second. What I try to stay away from are absolute concepts like zero. Almost never is anything zero. It might be very, very close to zero. It might be 0.0005, but it's never zero. Any non-superconducting material is going to have loss. There's obviously some small amount of loss on antenna tuners. If there wasn't, people wouldn't pay the premium to get silver-plated inductors. So although, as I mentioned before, the amount of loss in a antenna tuner is not high, the overwhelming majority is lost in attenuation loss on the transmission line, there is a non-zero loss in the antenna tuner. It's not a lot higher than zero, but it's full non-zero.
Agreed, Roy. Absolutely. That's what I meant by you need expensive equipment. There's some YouTube videos of guys much smarter than I am, of course, testing that and doing it. They show it on HP equipment that there's almost zero loss. And again, I say zero meaning zero to me and you because we don't really care with an ham radio. But it's almost immeasurable. You can't measure it on a nano VNA, let's put it that way.
Yes, I don't want to bump Ed again, but you, what do you want to say, Jeff?
Sorry, ACPL Jeff and Tom. I've opened up antenna tuners, old Dentrons, really built like a brick, and found melted components in there. I think it's absolutely absurd to say that there's zero loss in those things. You can't state that with all conditions and all antennas that you're feeding. That's just a nonsense.
Okay, but I think the general gist of what we're all sort of saying, with a little bit of plus or minus, is that used reasonably, the amount of resistance and energy loss in a functioning impedance transforming antenna tuner is not a great deal. There are things that can go terribly wrong that probably cause that problem in the antenna tuner. For severe mismatches, with high Qs and such, there are high voltage arcs that are possible. And those voltage arcs can produce intense heat and damage a lot of components. So I don't think it's just the resistive losses that are gone in killing an antenna tuner mostly. It's more of these terrible, disastrous causes for thermal runaway. Okay, Ed, WB2EAV, you want to say something?
Yeah, I was on about 2 minutes, but I've been listening for a while. A couple of thoughts. First of all, an antenna tuner with a reasonable starting SWR will dissipate very little power, and a quality unit with lost gauge silver plate coils will dissipate very little power. A cheap one with narrow non-silver plated wire will display more, but still, it is relatively very small. We get into trouble. It's if you're trying to use an antenna tuner to load extreme SWRs, if you have a really high impedance antenna, you're going to get some really high voltage peaks. And if you have a really low impedance radiating antenna, you're going to get some high current peaks. And those can cause heating, damage, what have you. But you really should not use your antenna tuner to put a kilowatt to a coupling kind of heaters. I mean, you're just wasting everybody's time. Second item, the problem with SWR is at the transmitter. treads are very sensitive to SWR because the transmitter is designed to run at a particular efficiency, a particular heating level, and that's where a bad SWR raises up the heating enough that you can damage the transmitter. The rest of the entire system, the antenna elements, coaxial or transmission lines, all of that stuff, as long as you're dealing with reasonable starting SWRs, are pretty much SWR intolerance, only when you're trying, like I said, put a kilowatt of coupling.
Chuck, I agree with you. I think we're all pretty much in agreement. We're arguing with little bits and pieces of you know, human language and such. I'm a big fan of antenna tuners, but I understand there's always a price to be paid. Mother Nature doesn't hand things out for free. So as long as you understand what you're doing and how it's doing it, you shouldn't have that much of a problem. Any other comments on this subject before we move on?
November 2, this is Lou Charlie.
Yes, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yeah, Roy, since we're on the subject, what is the reliable way, if you want to measure the output on your antenna, just say what your efficiency is, reliable way to do that?
Well, that's a very good question, and I have very bad answers. I really don't know how you can do it, on an amateur radio operator's budget. There's too many variables. You can approximate by using the chart that I mentioned, but that's not going to give you an absolute number. You can infer it by taking energy measurements over a isotropic field, and then integrating them and coming up with the answer. If you're in military and you got a couple of $1 million in anechoic chambers and such, but I mean, I'm curious, is there anyone out there who knows of a legitimately, relatively, non-ridiculously difficult way to get a better idea of efficiencies than what I've mentioned?
B2BXO.
Yes, Frank?
Yeah, I wonder if one of the tennis emission programs will do what you want them to do. I think there's, I've never tried any of them. I think there's something called Easy NEC. I think there are a bunch of those. Might one of those do what you want?
I don't think so. I've used them. They're very good for radiating antennas. They're not terribly good transmission lines. You can sort of use those. There's more than a few antennas that the characteristics of the transmission line has to be part of the calculation to get the proper resonances and such. But it's so basically easy to screw up. So I do not think at this point you can constructively plug in the numbers and have it come out and say it's 12.3% efficient. It might give you a very vague ballpark, but probably vaguer than if you just look up the transmission line manufacturer's approximate the calculations of how SWR and length affect attenuation losses.
DDH, would it comment?
Yes, John?
Yeah, other than maybe a microwave antennas in an anechoic chamber, as you mentioned, there really is no way of doing that because you need to really sum up around the entire surface of a sphere how much power is across that surface. And as I said, that could probably be done in an anechoic chamber when you're at microwave frequencies. But try to do it in the real world is probably next to impossible. But
yeah, that's my understanding. The military, I believe, actually are capable of doing that. They have the anechoic chambers, they have the staff, and they have the budget. It's probably the most important portion of this. Habs don't have any of that. So again, I think for us poor folk. The best that we have is Googling the manufacturers of our coax cables, like LMR 400, and go searching for lookup tables that they've used to calculate the approximate, summation attenuation losses based upon length, frequency, and SWRs.
Charlie?
Yep.
Yeah, many years ago I built a 5-band W transmitter out of the ARO at manual, and it took me a few years learning experience, and the way they recommended to tune it and the way that I did it was that I used a 100-watt light bulb, so, as sort of a dummy load, and, it worked. And I'm just wondering, could you not just hook up, say, a 100-watt light bulb, connecting it on the antenna itself? Would that work?
I'm not sure how you would find, how would you discern the efficiency of the emission? You have a complex system now. You have some of it going into, the light bulb, and some of it being radiated out the radiating antenna. So I don't know how you'd be able to reconstruct the total energy output of the antenna that way.
Yeah, my thinking would be, adjusting to a wattage, voltage, current, that if you're getting that much voltage and current onto the antenna, that's what is reaching the antenna, and not that you were discussing earlier being reflected back and forth and being wasted, etc. Now, I know it's sort of a complex system, probably a lot of flaws in that, but just basically, I think it was, sounds reasonable that you're measuring on the antenna itself. If it goes to the transmission line, it gets to any mismatches, what's actually there?
AC2GS. The problem, though, is if you change the load characteristic in any way, you change the efficiency. The result efficiency, if you swapped out your resident antenna for a resident antenna, is significantly different. So, kind of pulling all the power out through a light bulb and measure a current and current voltage would change the resonance of the radiating antenna, and then again, still, if you keep the radiating antenna there, you have something that's dissipating some of your energy. So even if it was a 100% efficient antenna, and you put a battery above in it, and then measured the bulb's voltage and current, you would find that its efficiency wouldn't make any sense because all of a sudden, some of the energy is being radiated and not showing up on the light bulb. So a 100% theoretically efficient antenna plugged into a 100-watt light bulb will give you a less than 100% efficient system on the bulb's reading.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John?
Yeah, I just want to make sure the definition of efficiency would be power transmitted over the complete surface of an enclosing sphere divided by power delivered to the antenna terminals. So somehow you have to sum up all of the power that's being transmitted that's crossing that surrounding sphere with the antenna in the middle of it. And you'd have to sum up that power, and then you'd have to divide that by power delivered to the antenna terminals times 100%.
Right, and that's why you would need an anechoic chamber to do that. Any other comments on the subject? Feel free. Hit that push to talk.
Ed Taylor.
That's all for you, Ed?
Just a little comment.
Certainly.
That's why open wire line is to some extent better because of low loss with open wire line, but it's very difficult to install. One of my relatives years ago, he drilled two holes in the glass window and ran the open wire line out of that. But most of us, are not going to do that. RCA Radio Central, they did a lot of point-to-point communication with, I imagine, quite a bit of power, but they used traveling wave antennas. They used very rhombics, and the rhombic needed a resistor at the end. Believe it or not, so much power was dissipated on the of wire of the rhombic that the resistor, believe it or not, was almost nothing at the end. The man that was running these stations out there has shown me what they used. They had a very, very tiny resistor at the end of the rhombic, and the rhombic was also fed with open wire line over.
Yeah. Traveling wave antennas, which are relatively rare. There's only a few that amateur radio operators are familiar with. I think one of the big two of the big ones are the rhombics and the beverage. The beverage being primarily a receiving antenna design. Work in mysterious, work in different ways. They are non-resident antennas. There's no such thing as matching impedances. They work on different principles, and a well-designed one does not have that much energy to bleed off to the terminating resistor. You have too much, then you're going to burn out that resistor eventually. So well-designed traveling waves have that. But yeah, people don't talk about doublets. They're, doublets are non-resonance center-fed dipole-like antennas, but they're not cut to a resonant frequency. And the transmission that they use is not coaxial cables with a high, loss, but open line, which has a relatively very low attenuation loss. You can get away with it bouncing back and forth, 10, 15 times. The price that you pay, as you mentioned, is that it's very fiddly. It suffers from isolation problems. Coaxial cables' major benefit that they are highly isolated. You can take two transmission lines, put them right next to each other if they're coax, and there's no problem. You try to do that with two open lines, and you're going to have nothing but problems. And back in the old days when people didn't have coax transmission line because it was expensive before World War II, people learned how to properly use open line. Nowadays, it's probably very people who understand how to treat open line quite right. But there's still people out there using it and enjoying the benefits of it.
Charlie.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I used to converse with a gentleman, and excuse me, I've got his call sign. He only antenna factory out of California. I remember him once explaining a way to me to measure the length of the coax, how it's supposed to be cut to the frequency work, and it's in quarter wave segments. And he was telling me correctly that you would short it out with a 50 ohm resistor, and then, using your antenna analyzer, check it with that, and then cut the coax, try to get the best match that way as far as the whole theory with mismatches according to antenna wire length. Any thoughts on that?
AC2GS. Sure, John. A matter of fact, after people get tired of arguing about antenna tuners, they argue about whether there's optimum length for transmission lines. If you have a properly resonant antenna, the length of transmission line has no effect. The problem is if they're mismatched, because transmission lines transform impedances along the length of the transmission line. So that's why, when you're taking your test for tech or general or extra, it asks if you short a length of coax at what end, what is it reading on the other end, and depending upon the length in terms of wavelength, it transforms it to the exact opposite or the same. So if you are at a disadvantage and your antenna is non-resonant. The non-resonant impedance will rotate along the length of your transmission line, such that I once had a weird problem. My antenna tuner would not tune or tenders my antenna. I put an extra length of transmission line, 3 feet, and all of a sudden, the same exact antenna tuner was now able to transform the impedance to 50 ohms. That's the extra 3 feet of transmission line allowed the impedance to rotate into a type of impedance that the circuits for the antenna tuner could fix. So there is no real inherent correct length for a trans line. As long as you keep in mind the rotation of impedances when there's a mismatch, and also having common mode. In some cases, you can put up an antenna with a centered dipole without choke, and you won't get any common mode. If you change the length of the transmission line, you can induce a common mode current on the transmission line. But if you put an RF choke, you don't even have to worry about that. So ultimately, the length of your transmission line is probably the least important aspect of all of this. Other than the attenuation losses get worse as you get a longer and longer transmission line.
Okay, Roy, I definitely don't want to misquote you, so I just want to make sure that I understood what you said in one comment, that the transmission line really is unimportant as long as you have a resonant antenna. That's what I understood. Correct me if I'm wrong in that. So I'm going under that assumption. Correct, I misunderstood you. But then let's just say these stepper IR beams that are self-tuning that actually configure the length of the radiating element dimatch. If we employ, such an antenna in the system, then by going by what you said, if I understood correctly, any length of cable would have become, irrelevant in the scheme of SWR. Would that be accurate to the thing?
Yep.
Very interesting, Roy. Thank you.
You're welcome. Like I said, if you go down to 75 meters, you can have a fight with either topic. But if you want a third topic, there's always people who tell you that you should never coax cable. You have extra coax cable, and you're not cutting it short to length. The exit should be wound in a serpentine manner, never a loop, because that would reduce inductance and produce impedance mismatches, and that's all nonsense. So that's the third kind of weird thing that you'll hear on 75 meters.
Yeah, one other thing, when I was listening and doing my reading, when we have these GARM antennas, or the antennas that tune multiple bands, these dipole antennas that cut to tune multiple bands, and they always require a certain amount of open fed wire, being connected to the antenna. And it's my student, correct if I'm wrong, what's happening is then that your antenna tuner is tuning actually part of the old wire, is actually part of the radiating antenna, a certain length of it, and that's why you're able to get a match. Would that be, would you agree with that?
Yes. G5RV antennas are very complicated multimodal antennas. I mean by that they operate using print segments as part of the radiator in some bands and as transition line other bands in order to give you these multi-band resonances. And explanations of actually how G5RV antennas jump from one mode to another can give one a headache. But that's the underlying concept. At different frequencies, different segments of the G5RV switch between being part of the transmission line or being part of the radiator. And that affects all kinds of things, including the resonances and what the antenna tuner has to do to kind of, fix things. Well-designed G5RVs should either resonant or very close to resonant, so the antenna tuner should only have to tweak it at best. But the reason why there's these multiple resonances are because the different components are treated as different things on different bands.
Okay, and that radiated element is sometimes a radiating element and sometimes an antenna feed. A portion of it is an antenna, a portion of it is an antenna feed. That's how it's treated. And that would also go for the open wire itself, too. Sometimes I believe that a certain section of the open feed also becomes a radiating element on that system.
Well, I mean, you can have common mode on any transmission line, and differential mode operates differently. It's isolated, the field is self-contained, and it shouldn't really radiate any significant RF. But any transmission line can go into a common mode, and it acts as a radiator. Part of that is what's going on the G5RV. Sometimes the transmission line is acting as a radiator. Sometimes it's acting as a transmission line. Sometimes it's acting as a stub that transforms the impedance across the distance of that transforming transmission line.
In a way, Roy, it's similar to you. Sometimes you act as an Elmer, and sometimes as a referee. All right, thank you again, Roy.
You're very welcome, and I prefer the Elmer part to the referee, but you know, sometimes you gotta. But thank you. Any other comments on this subject?
WB2BX, though.
Yes, Frank.
Yeah, as a practical matter, that barring a fancy way of actually doing objective measurements, the only way to have a good idea the antenna is performing is to compare it to somebody else's antenna to see how it's doing. And if you have a moment, though, go through a comparison I did with a neighbor some years ago. Go ahead.
Sure, no problem. Yeah, I mean, ultimately what we do at AMS is make our comparisons based on practical experiences. How far do you hear people? How far do people respond to your transmissions versus either other antennas that you have plugged in for comparison's sake or neighbors' experiences in the same rough approximate location using different technology? So it's not, you know, it's not as ironclad as the military with their anechoic chamber, but since you don't have really much else to go with, anecdotal stories are probably the best. But I'd be more than hearing your comparison that you made, Frank.
Yeah, very good. This was probably about 50 years ago, 51 years ago, on my old station in Canarsie. They had a neighbor up the block, KLO2 Sierra Echo Radio. I don't know whether he's still around or not. Anyway, he was up the block on East 6th Street, between Avenue N and between the L, between Avenue L and Avenue M, and was down the block. I was on Avenue M between 95th and 96th, for those on frequency who are familiar with the old neighborhood. Anyway, so we're probably a couple of hundred feet apart. He had a mini product, mini beam, and I had a halfway dipole on 20 meters, and he insisted his mini beam was doing spectacularly well, and I thought by listening to his QSOs that it really wasn't doing any better than my dipole at about the same height on 20 meters. So we got our 20 meters together one afternoon and called a couple of Europeans, I think, and discovered that his very shortened mini beam, which was element much heavily loaded and much too short for 20 meters, was really about as effective as my heavy dipole spread between the clothesline pole and the house at 30 feet, at about the same height. He swore his beam was fantastically effective. Go ahead.
Okay, I hope you didn't depress him too much. You know, the problem with anecdotal reports is that they're anecdotal, that they're lacking in all kinds of hard and firm numbers, and it really is just your attitude. If you're an optimist, you're doing great. If you're a pessimist, you're doing crappy. Because, you know, it's very difficult to compare temporally through time. So, you know, and also, you know, one antenna might be great for gain, and another antenna might be good as a more omnidirectional antenna, which is a little bit more difficult to discern over the short haul. So it's a very difficult thing to kind of win at, because I'm sure your friend had a lot of excuses why his wasn't operating as well as yours, or better than yours at that time, right?
Honestly, going back 50-some-odd years, I don't really remember exactly. You know, and there could have been all kinds of different reasons, and we tried it at different times of day. The results might have been slightly different. But it was interesting. Anyway, yeah, but as you say, there can be endless arguments. I remember talking to another guy in Brooklyn who swore antenna was working wonderfully on 40 meters, and I could barely hear him, and he was in the neighborhood, and he hardly ever worked for anybody, and he could swear his random wire was working. You know, so unless you have a comparison, you don't have any real idea. That's my two cents,
Jeff. I appreciate your tips, Worth, Frank. I mean, that's the problem. That's why it's always nice to have hard and fast numbers to back people's opinion, because emotion kind of guides much of us, and if we feel good about a thing, we think it's better than other people's thing, and very often we're wrong. So with antennas, ultimately, you know, as I always kind of fall back, if you're not having fun doing it wrong, you know, if you're happy with your antenna, God bless. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'd be happy with your antenna, but I'm not you. So, you know, it's all good, as long as you're happy with it. If you're unhappy with it, then you can come here and we can discuss different types of antennas and different options. And, you know, that's kind of the main variable in our hobby. There's only so many manufacturers of radios, and almost no one can build one by themselves anymore. Whereas, if you get a piece of wire, you could put up an antenna. You could put up any weird antenna that you can imagine. So there's a lot of variable aspects in our hobby to antenna design and how to mount it and where to mount it and where to point it and what do we get out of it. So and there's always that.
Yeah, I mean, and location makes a lot of difference. Back in, I think it was 1990, I was on a ham radio tour of the some Caribbean islands with the Ebonair Amateur Radio Club, the Ears Group, which may still be at the Queens. And I sat down at a station on top of a volcano on the island of Dominica and checked into a net on 20 meters. They're looking for a phone patch back to New York. The station who was net control had to go use the Felicities and said, "Hey, that really loud station didn't catch your call, but why don't you run the net for a couple of minutes?" And I'm like, okay, I know this guy's antenna works.
Okay, very good. Yeah, in the good old days with Dick, the discussions of antennas were the regular thing. Dick's expertise, when it came down to it, was he designed antennas for all kinds of situations. And so that's the most important aspect. You know, I know people who kind of give a percentage and He said, antennas are 83.752% of your shack. I'm not quite sure where that number comes from, but it's important, and that's probably why we talk a lot about them.
I would say antenna and location. I've had a chance using network of remote stations, with very similar antennas in different locations, one in particular in the Hudson Valley, and one overlooking Long Island Sound, and with nearly identical antennas and identical radios, there's a significant difference. So I'm kind of convinced that location, as well as the antenna itself, what makes an important difference. And yeah, the power level matters by a couple of dBs, but there just aren't that many dBs difference between 100 watts and the legal limit. I'm sure someone's going to argue with me on that one too. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, they all are a factor in how good or bad things are. But I think that if you threw a lot of money at antennas, you would probably get greater improvement than if you threw a lot of money on location. You know, location, primarily the most important thing is, you know, don't plant your shack in a valley. Dick found an elevated bit of land in Long Island that he bought and put his antennas up on. So you want elevation, and you want to be free of nearby large objects blocking your signal. But that's about all. Whereas with antennas, you can go crazy. You can stack multiple phased arrays and do all kinds of things that you could plummet hundreds of thousands of dollars in antenna riggers and supplies and such, and you know, have your own lovely little contest station.
Yeah, and the same guy who rents access to his stations also will gladly come and put up antennas for you at your home station. I have no idea probably a hefty sum of money. Of course, it's up to you to either get permits or bribe your local zoning board to allow your stacking of towers. Go ahead.
B2GS. I don't know if they're still rigging. They started out rigging, and I think they got into the remote station business, I think because they were a little bit annoyed with rigging. They, you know, a lot of riggers end up having had opinions of customers for some strange reason. Barry, towards the end of his antenna installation business, said that he doesn't want to do it anymore because the customers are too annoying. So the last time I talked to all these guys way back when I was trying to figure out how to get antennas on my roof, and these guys just kind of told me that they cost a lot of money and I wouldn't want to pay that much, and besides, we're getting out of the business and we're going into this remote radio station business. So I'm not quite sure if they're still riggers. There was another rigger out of Pennsylvania who told me that my desires for my antenna were completely wrong. I shouldn't get a fan dipole that went from 10 to 80. I should get an antenna that's only directional and only from 20 to 10, and that basically I have my entire roof rebuilt from scratch, and then contact him, and he even told me how much per mile to travel to Brooklyn it was. It would have cost me $50,000 to get an antenna on my roof with this chuckle guy.
Yeah, I believe it. The guys are no longer, because they still use the same LLC. I didn't know they were completely out of the antenna rigging business, but I could certainly believe it wasn't worth the trouble. The liability insurance alone to do it commercially must be totally crazy now.
Yeah, I don't know the economics of it. I got an impression that the you know, interaction between customer and and the business was problematic. And I only saw it in that guy from Pennsylvania who wanted to put up a spider a beam. When I said, how am I going to use it for 80 or 40? He said, you don't need it for 80 or 40. You don't need to use 80 or 40. So I said, okay, he now knows what I need and what I don't need. And especially, you know, the idea that he wanted me to rebuild the entire roof because he wanted to put up a roof mount, you know, kind of a partial roof tower. I don't know. It was a very sad thing reading his email.
Yeah, this doesn't sound like somebody who understands realities of urban amateur radio, and that you just can't necessarily rebuild your roof to accommodate the antennas, and obviously that's a project, and think about all kinds of problems. It's, I can understand that. Yeah, it depends on what you want to do. Most of his customers just probably want to work DX, and even though it's a lot of fun to work DX on your lower frequencies and get extra endorsements for the awards, you don't necessarily do that. If you want to talk closer in reliably, you need 40 and 80 meters. You can't do that on most reliably on 20, 15, and 10. Nearby locations, get it?
Yeah, I think most of the people who use professional antenna riggers have tracts of flat land where they can build towers. I don't think most people hire these particular types of guys to put ovens on their roofs. You know, they hire handymen or something to put up things on the roofs. But antenna riggers are for when you want, you know, multi-stacked phase arrays on 100 or 200 foot towers in your field someplace.
Yeah, probably. But even an installation like a TH6 on a 50-foot tower, if you want it done right, you're probably better off hiring somebody who knows what they're doing. Or an old 204BA or one of those old antennas. I guess these days, the more modern antennas are the steppers and stuff. But, I think overall, you're right. I only know one guy in my old club in Brooklyn in the 70s who had professional antenna riggers put up his antennas, and he was a dentist, and back then Mason area was still relatively upscale, and he had a professional antenna rigger put up antennas for him and his son. And he actually went to Japan to buy his radios. There weren't a lot of Japanese radios being imported yet in those days, apparently. I think there were. I'm not sure I really understand why he bought his radios in Japan and brought them back. But anyway, that was the kind of character he was. So go ahead.
Well, maybe he wanted an excuse to travel to Japan. Maybe there was some kind of tariff that he wanted to get out from under or something. Who knows? Dentists work in mysterious ways. But I don't know. I think they're making more money these days than they were back then. But still, you know, you got money. You know, as long as you don't ask me for some of it, you want to spend it on your hobby, so be it. I mean, there are guys down south building pseudo-contest stations, plowing hundreds of thousands of dollars into their system. You know, God bless them.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of amazing the amount of money people will spend to win home radio contests when all you get is a little certificate or plaque, for God's sake. It's a lot of fun to win a contest, but, you know, you don't get anything back on your investment.
Well, you get the bragging rights. I understand that, theoretically. I've never been bit by the contesting bug. When I land on a band and they're doing contesting, my eyes roll backwards and I almost go into a coma. I don't know. I never got bit. I never get bit from wallpaper collecting, you know. I play around with FT8. It's a fascinating technology. I don't think I would spend the amount of hours that some people spend on FPA. But again, whatever makes you happy.
FPA is interesting to see what propagation is really doing when everyone is on one frequency. Especially interesting on a clear frequency where you can hear the signal barely wobble in the noise if you can hear it at all and make a solid contact halfway around the world 3 hours after sunset on 50 meters. You know, it's kind of weird. Something else on the band. Anyway, tell you one lasting propagation story. Yesterday evening, I worked Bravo Alpha 4, Tango Bravo, BF4TB, I think in the Shanghai area, just after sunset here. And I was one of the few guys who worked him before he faded out. And I looked him up on QRZ. I've never even heard a Chinese station on 40 meters before. All right, let me look this guy up. And it turned out his sunset was 21:30, and it was now like 00:05. I'm like, really? 3 hours after sunrise, and he has propagation halfway around the world? I don't think I've ever... At least at this time of year, I haven't heard that kind of propagation on 40 meters before. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it's the unpredictability of this hobby that I think a lot of people are attracted to. If it was 100% dependable and, you know, worked like the Japanese train system, I think a lot of guys get bored of it and find some other hobby elsewhere.
Yeah, well, we may see in a couple of years when geosynchronous amateur satellite covering North America becomes reality, which I think it will, since a group from the Emirates already put one up that covers the Eastern Hemisphere. So I doubt very much European and American hands are not going to find a way to match them. That'll be interesting because that'll be 100% coverage, 24 hours a day, just get on there and work me to once. So that should be interesting. Go ahead.
Well, you never quite know what you know. So sometimes the things you want the most are the worst things you get. You know, that dependability and consistency might be the death toll to the hobby. If everyone knows that they can get on at any time and talk to someone else, you know, it ends up being like the internet again. So a lot of people really get upset when anyone talks about, you know, digital gateway things where the internet backbone is a major part of it. So I don't know if that'll help hobby in some ways or hurt the hobby in other ways.
November 2, Zulu Charlie?
Yes, John?
Yeah, just to piggyback on what you're saying there, Roy, I remember a radio interview with W2ML, and the person conducting the interview said, you know, with today's technology, as you said, you know, you can get on the internet and speak to somebody from the other world, and, you know, why would people still even, you know, have this interest in ham radio? And he very eloquently replied that you could get on an ocean liner and you can travel the world, but it's always that allure and excitement of getting in a sailboat and traveling the world, a whole different challenge. And I agree with you, if this hobby ever becomes something similar to a telephone, what is the allure?
Yeah, we agree. Usually the response that I give people is that the infrastructure is completely different. In order to be able to talk around the world on the internet, you need underseas fiber optic cables that have to be maintained. They break every so often. You need repeaters to repeat the signal. You need billions and billions of dollars of infrastructure. In order to, on a good day, talk to that guy in South Africa, you basically need a couple of $100 of equipment and antenna.
Yes, yes, and it's the challenge, it's the, and the amount of time that you have to, whether it's winning a woman, whether it's getting military, or learning the ins and outs like this.
Yeah, agreed. Well, you know, I mean, challenge is kind of a two-edged sword, because there's a lot of challenges that no one would waste their time with that are challenging. You know, I mean, how long could you hold your breath in the toilet bowl? It's easily accessible. It's usually a couple of yards away, and you can get a cocktail, stopwatch, all kinds of things. Not too many people are going to stick their head in the toilet bowl for that challenge, so, thankfully.
Oh, yes, yes, and that's, I think, one of the saving grounds. It attracts a certain type of individual that, you know, putting together a ham radio station takes a certain amount of commitment and dedication, time and challenge. So, you know, I think it is one of the braces. I was a little bit against the no code, et cetera. I don't even want to get into that because, again, I think it's... made a very unique
group. Well, yeah, if it makes you feel any better, I mean, I think that Morse code, CW, has had a kind of renaissance in the last 10, 15 years. I've heard interviews of people that sell high-end keys, and they've never sold more keys than they are now. And, of course, there's our own Long Island CW club trying to promote CW. Paul is an avid CW guy, and so even though, you know, there were fears that it would just kind of fade away and no one would even know what CW stood for, that doesn't seem to have been the case.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and like so many times, total opposite effect of what you anticipated. That's interesting, and to diagnose that. Ham radio voices by that CW. Very interested, and I was very, very interested, and I was very impressed by how there were, and, well, or refined a whole year curriculum learning CW. And I think, yeah, they developed a way, or yeah, one way out there they're a very serious organization.
Yeah, they love CW, and they want people to respect it as well. It's understandable. I know there's a couple of different learning methods. There's a lot of good software out there that can simulate. They can teach people at their own pace, and then once you get it all down, they'll introduce some fake Chansey and QR Mary and static and fade, and all kinds of fun stuff, and do whatever you need to get you on the air doing CW. So it's not dead. It's not anywhere close to dead, thankfully. There's still, I collect the books with Bailey. They call them Morse, Morse key porn. They have glamour shots of beautifully done Morse code key. I have one made out of chrome that was hand designed from two guys in the United Kingdom about 10 years ago, which is only little key. Anyway, anyone with any other comments? What I would like to bring up just for a second or two, and I'm not quite sure if I'm going to get any kind of reply. I'm curious about the Netflix had a first season of the three-body problem, and I haven't heard anyone really talk about it. I've only seen the first three episodes so far, but I've read the books. And I'm curious if anyone out there saw any of it and has any opinion one way or the other about it.
So, Charlie?
Yes, John?
Yeah, no, nothing about it. First time I'm hearing about it. Maybe you could fill us in just what it's about.
Okay, it's a little bit complicated, but I'll do my best. It originated as a trilogy, a three-book novel. It was written by a Chinese author in, the Communist China. And it was a bestseller there, and it got translated. And it was a bestseller in the United States, all over Europe and such. It has an interesting premise. The premise is that there's some really upset person who's manning using one of those radio telescope stations where they're looking for intelligent alien life, and they send a welcome on a radio astronomy transmitter, and they get back a reply basically says, "I am a pacifist. Please do not repeat your signal. Do not send more signals." And unfortunately, this particular person didn't take the advice and sent some more signals out there into space. And a bunch of aliens in Alpha Centauri decided that they would like to take our planet from us. Except that it takes about, I don't know, what, 200-300 years to get here, because I think 8 light years away. So this is the ensuing, basically, 1,000-year thereafter of how Earth people deal with a future invasion by aliens.
Okay, thank you.
Roy, what's the name of the three-body problem?
Yes, it's called the three-body problem, and there's a good reason why it's the three-body problem. Alpha Centauri is a three-star system. So, supposedly, this is a planet in the midst of that three-star system that's a chaotic three-body problem. You cannot calculate the long-term movements of any classical three-body problem. If one of the bodies is much smaller in mass, there are simplifications that you can come up with an approximation, but if the masses of all three bodies are close to the same, it's an impossible equation.
Okay, very good. Yes. That's what sounds like the same problem with the James Webb Space Telescope and anything out at the L2, Lagrange Point 2. They have the three-body problem with the sun, the Earth, and then the spacecraft itself. But just saying, because of the three-star system. Okay, very good. I'll look it up. I'm assuming this is an American show. I hope it's not one of these Chinese things with a subtitle.
Well, the Chinese did, in fact, produce own Chinese version, which I'm told is not terribly good, and they basically dropped a lot of the political overlay of it. But this particular one was produced in America. It's showed on Netflix. They do tend to use subtitle times for whatever reason. Most of it is English, but a little bit of it is in other languages with subtitles. It's interesting. Having read the three books, I kind of know what's going on, but I, in the back of my head as I watch it, I always kind of ask myself, if some guy sits down and has never opened the book, does he have the faintest idea what the hell's going on there? So hopefully I'll be able to talk some people into at least trying the first or, you know, first two. It's on Netflix. So people out there, if you have access to Netflix, it's called Three Body Problem. It's interesting, but again, I'm not quite sure if it's understandable if you haven't read the book.
Okay, I'll give it a shot. Thanks, Roy. I got Netflix. WS2S.
Okay, very good. I'll just throw it out one last time. If anyone out in the crowd actually saw at least one episode, I'm just curious that way. I'd love to know if anyone had an idea of what was going on. Okay, I guess we don't have that many Netflix subscribers or sci-fi watchers. I've always been a big fan of science fiction. I guess that's why I'm interested in science as well. I've been reading science fiction since I learned to read way back. Anyway, it's been loads of fun. Hopefully we'll do it again real soon, like next week. So thanks for everyone who participated tonight, and have a great week. For those who observed, Passover is coming up real soon, so, you know, buy your matzah and get ready for that. Anyway, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. It's been loads of fun. I'll be back in a little while after Paul. But now it's a perfect time for WS2N's Spaceport.
Okay, thanks, Roy. And I don't think I'll be able to go all the way to 11. isn't all that much new this whole week. Once in a while there's a lull in the action. But I do have a couple of topics we can go through here.